There's a group that's become, in many ways, the Paul Revere of the anti-globalization movement, and it's called the Third World Network. They told us about the World Trade Organization before anybody had heard. Yao Graham is the director of Third World Network Africa. He is a longtime opponent of structural adjustment programs and indeed has served prison time in his native Ghana for his opposition to the implementation of a particularly brutal structural adjustment program. He's also led in the formation of African networks on trade and on development and on economic policy. Please welcome Yao Graham.
Good evening to you all. I think the point Bill made at the end of his presentation and also at the start about the importance of mainstreaming this international struggle into our national politics is extremely important. I want to underline that because coming from Ghana, which at the moment is a symbol for those who see the new imperialism as a way forward, a country which is an important cog in the push of neoliberal economics, a country which has become an example which is held up by those who falsely claim that a neoliberal model is working. It is important for those of us who struggle together globally to also deepen our struggles at the national level. And I think what US citizens can do in the heartland of the most powerful pillar of the new imperialism is, needless to say, of great strategic significance for all of us. So for that, I think I'm very pleased to join you here this evening as part of the mobilization against the coming IMF World Bank meetings. Because, as you all know, Africa is the site of the largest collection of countries which are undergoing structural adjustment. If the way the IMF treated the Asian financial crisis could be compared to carpet bombing, what the IMF has been doing in Africa has been a long war of attrition. The effects, of course, are the same, whether it's carpet bombing or it's a war of attrition. The financial crisis that engulfed Southeast Asia has been well spoken about. Of course, Africa is not part of the mainstream of the emerging markets. Only a few countries in that continent are considered sufficiently robust in terms of their financial sector to be part of the global financial system in terms of, say, active movement or speculative capital. But having said that, Africa was also caught up in the waves that came out of the Asian financial crisis. And in that sense, the impact of the financial crisis fed what I would like to describe as a long-standing casino of the global commodities market. In a certain sense, the current struggle to get some regulation of international capital movements is very similar to what developing countries struggled for in the 60s and 70s in terms of trying to stabilize commodity prices. Because commodities have been long subject to speculation. Currently, in most African countries, after years of embracing structural adjustment and accepting the claim that export-driven growth will be the way forward, once again, a crash in commodity prices has left many economies in crisis, or should I say worsened the crisis of these economies, so that the casino economy at the world level operates in diverse ways. In some places, is in terms of, say, the quick movement of speculative capital in and out. In some places, it is a sudden drop in commodity prices. Speculators, of course, make money. But countries whose lives depend on commodity earnings are suddenly left with shortfalls in income. And in the countryside, peasants whose livelihoods depend on these incomes have their lives devastated. The situation has been made worse in quite a number of countries because under the aegis of the IMF World Bank policies, marketing boards have been removed. One unspoken factor in the recent coup d'etat in Côte d'Ivoire was the fact that the long-standing marketing board for cocoa in that country and coffee were dismantled on the orders of the IMF and World Bank. So the protection that farmers enjoyed of a stable domestic price, something which is available by way of, say, subsidies for farmers in the big industrial countries, was no longer available for these farmers. Cocoa prices crashed. Farmers actually took to cutting down their farms, but the cocoa was not worth harvesting. This was the context of social turmoil, in addition, of course, to other things that made a coup d'etat possible. So when I read the reports about how suddenly, in the Western press, that is, that suddenly from nowhere, a model of stability and economic growth in Africa has suffered a coup d'etat with no reference to the contributions of these kinds of economic processes, once again, one found a lie being told. But I think I want to pick up this point about the roller coaster in a number of dimensions and link it a bit more clearly to the role of the IMF. Because the process of neoliberal economics in the African context has centered around increasing, as I said, the production of commodities for export. The collapse in prices leads to declining incomes. The declining incomes lead to domestic budgetary crisis, which generate their own pressure for further opening up because the countries are faced with increased indebtedness. The pressure to open up, of course, means greater liberalization. And greater liberalization means greater subjection to the conditionalities of the IMF and World Bank. In 1998, for example, Africa suffered a 17% drop in its export earnings, even as the volume of exports increased. In that same year, the continent's terms of trade declined by 13%. Now, this is in a context where very savage processes of liberalization had resulted in growth in the dependence on export commodities. But alongside this also, extreme liberalization of the investment regime had led to, at least in, say, mineral and extractive sector resource-endowed countries, to an influx of foreign direct investment. It is extremely disputable whether, in fact, these countries are making net gains from this inflow of foreign direct investment. Why do I say that? Because the liberalized terms mean that in almost all cases, the firms are protected from any tax for any period ranging up to 10 years. They can bring in a whole range of things duty-free with exemption. And also, the structure of the investment means that very few of them actually declare corporate profits to be subject to taxation. In Ghana, for example, which has the single largest concentration of open cast gold mines in its western region, a western region which also happens to be the only remaining area of high forest in the country, not a single mine which has operated there since the mid-70s has actually declared profit for tax purposes internally. But none of those mines has a life of more than 10 years. Most of them have an average life of about 6 years. So within 6 years, they are finished, no profits declared, and they are gone. When the price of gold declined, some of these firms were actually opened by firms which are engaged in speculation. They wanted to make quick money on, on, on gold prices. When the prices dropped, they shot and moved. Of course, the environmental legislation is very weak. So in addition to the destruction of the environment, there's also the question about there being not even any net material gain to a local economy. Local livelihoods were devastated, rivers polluted. You can take this story in any number of African countries, because if you look at the pattern of investment flow, which is meant to signal the success of, say, liberalization, you find that actually it has gone mainly into the extractive sector. And it is not creating jobs of any type. In the countries which have attempted to create, say, EPZs of the type that Bill was talking about, you find the replication of exactly the same conditions of workers working under very repressive conditions with job insecurity, with very poor pay. Despite this, of course, indebtedness has increased on the continent. You've been given some figures already, but just to repeat some of them. Despite the claim that adjustment and liberalization brings improvements, in 1990, the debt of Africa was $294 billion. In 1998, it was $342 billion. $342 billion. Of the 41 highly indebted countries listed by the IMF and World Bank, 33 African countries. Interestingly, Ghana, which is the longest-running adjustment show in Africa, which in every pamphlet, piece of paper put up by the IMF and World Bank, is a success story. The country's debt has grown from $1.2 billion in 1982, just before the start of adjustment, to over $6 billion as of 1999. In 1982, the country could not, by any stretch of the imagination, be described as a highly indebted, poor country. By 1999, in the year 2000, it is listed as such, despite the claim that it is a great success story for adjustment. And what has happened in the Ghanaian economy recently is very illustrative of the trends I'm talking about. With the collapse of cocoa and gold prices, everything crashed. Late in 1999, it became official. The IMF, the World Bank, everybody agreed that the thing was in crisis. The value of the Ghanaian cedi, which was about 2,000 to the US dollar about a year ago, is now 4,000 plus to the US dollar. Interestingly, precisely because of this crisis, the country, of course, has become more dependent on international, say, credit. One of the possibilities for getting more credit would be to accept the terms of the highly indebted poor countries debt relief initiative. But the country is very dependent also on Japanese credit. Japan holds about 15% of Ghana's debt stock. And Japan, of course, is bitterly opposed to anything that smells of debt relief. So the Japanese say, take your pick. You get debt relief under HIPIC, you get no Japanese money. Now, the reason why this story is important is because it's supposed to be a model adjusting country which is successful. Only the extractive sector has attracted investment, and even that has been shown to be unsustainable. All it took was the drop in commodity prices and 17 years of structural adjustment, and the claims made for it has been exposed to be completely false. We could say this as indicative, as I said, of what is happening on the continent. And this is what makes it so important for us from the African continent, that the global movement against the role of the IMF and World Bank is deepening, and also more people are joining it. And that it is not simply a matter of solidarity, but also becoming a matter of concern in terms of how domestic politics in the major powers of the United States is played out. And I want to add that as we talk about the role of the IMF World Bank at the multilateral level and the need to make that a domestic political issue, there are domestic political issues of the same type which ought to be brought into the agenda. I'm talking here about the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is a bilateral initiative by the United States to effectively create a transatlantic NAFTA. The claim made for the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is that it represents a framework for increasing the benefits that African countries can get from capital flows from the United States. The Growth and Opportunity Act is not a Growth and Opportunity Act for Africa. It's a Growth and Opportunity Act for American capital. All the principles that we oppose within the programs of the IMF and World Bank are the core principles of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Those countries that fulfill the destructive demands of the bank and the fund are the ones which are supposed to benefit from capital flows, are the ones in respect of which OPEC would give support to American investment. So in fact, the Growth and Opportunity Act is an attempt to get national benefit, very focused national benefit for American business from what the IMF went back, is able to clear the path for. And I would like to urge you that in addition to the struggle against the IMF, World Bank, broadly speaking, right now before the Senate, the Growth and Opportunity Act is beginning to come back into the mainstream. Add the struggle against the Growth and Opportunity Act to the struggle against the IMF and World Bank, and that will be a very specific contribution to linking the international campaign with the national struggle. Thank you very much.
Miss Martin Kaur, but we welcome Yao Graham. Thank you for joining us. Our next speaker is a very hard person to introduce. Much of his work has been as a terrific researcher. He's written books. He's a terrific analyst. But I think most of us know him as one of the best organizers that North America has ever produced. And I think one of the reasons why Canada has emerged as an anti-globalization superpower is because of the work of Maude Barlow and our next speaker, Tony Clark. Tony first came onto our doorstep when the great presidents Bush and Salinas and Mulroney, Prime Minister of Canada, proposed something called the North American Free Trade Agreement. Tony created a model of organization, or help create a model of organization in Canada, an Action Canada network that pulled together segments of civil society. After the NAFTA fight, he and Maude and others helped transform this into a terrific engine of organizing against the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, a battle which they led and helped to win. It's terrific to work with him. He's now the head also of the Polaris Institute and the Corporations Committee of the International Forum on Globalization. Please welcome Tony Clark.
Thank you, John. I don't know what we would do. I don't know what to do with those kind of superlatives, and I don't know how other people respond either, but thank you very much. I would be remiss, however, in being in this building this evening, in this city, if we did not say, like the walls of Jericho in biblical times, the foundations of the American empire are shaking these days. We saw the fault lines opening up around the WTO in Seattle. And since last December, they've spread here, focusing in on the IMF in Washington. And I think I can say on behalf of everybody here this evening, wherever the global managers meet in the world, we, the representatives of civil society movements, will be there shaking the foundations one more time, one more time, one more time. And we know, as we gather with this panel here this evening, we know that the financial casino, where speculative rather than productive investments reign supreme, that this financial casino contains the fuel rods that fire the engines of corporate globalization. We have heard a great deal about the financial casino this evening, and we know that the electronic technology that allows currency traders to move around the world instantly, speculating on currencies and on commodity prices, that this is a major factor in the process. We also know that the rapid pace of financial deregulation that has been taking place all over the world in the last 10 years, where governments have surrendered their policy tools and the control that they have over the inflows and outflows of capital, is also a major factor. But when it comes to action, the question that is on our minds, I think, is what should be the major target? Should the major target be the IMF and the World Bank? Or are these the real engines of the global financial casino, or are there other engines that we should be focusing our agenda on as well? These are the kinds of questions I think that we need to wrestle with. This evening, I would like to bring back what John said earlier. I think he was right in saying that Bhagwati got it right on one thing, that we are dealing here fundamentally with a Wall Street Treasury complex. And of course, he was picking up on Eisenhower's military-industrial complex when he said this. But there is no question that what we are dealing with is that the driving forces behind the global financial casino today are really focused in on a very tight nexus that exists between the U.S. Treasury and Wall Street itself. And while Bhagwati didn't give us any great insights as to exactly how that system operates, I think it's important that we spend a little time trying to unpack it. The centerpiece of this engine, of course, are the world's money managers. They include the world's leading merchant and investment banks like Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Morgan Grenfell, Merrill Lynch, and Credit Suisse, First Boston, and a number of other big investment houses and speculators. It also includes that whole nexus of banks, whether we're talking about Citicorp and Chase Manhattan and Bank America, or Nations Bank and J.P. Morgan in this country, or Barclays and Deutsche Bank, or the Royal Bank of Canada, or the string of Tokyo-based banks in Japan. The fact is that these banks and investment houses, together they operate both as speculators and as creditors in global money markets. And through their speculative assaults, as Canadian economist Michelle Shevardnadze explains, they contribute to destabilizing national currencies and boosting the volume of dollar-dominated debts. Then they reappear as creditors with a view to collecting the debts. And finally, they are called in as policy advisors and consultants in the IMF World Bank-sponsored bankruptcy programs, of which they are the ultimate beneficiaries. In other words, the world's big money managers set countries on fire and then are called in as firemen to extinguish the blaze. Secondly, the U.S. Treasury essentially provides a financial safety net for these global money managers. Among the central banks of the G7 countries, the U.S. Treasury makes by far the largest lump sum contribution to the IMF-sponsored rescue operations. Now, this bailout money is not intended to, quote, rescue, unquote, countries facing bankruptcies at the hands of speculators who have taken a run at their currencies, but instead is earmarked to reimburse the commercial banks, investment houses, and brokerage firms which fueled the speculation in the first place. At the same time, the U.S. Treasury, and this is the case whether we're looking at Mexico in its $48 billion bailout, or Thailand with a $17 billion bailout, or Indonesia at $43 billion, or South Korea at $60 billion. We're talking about the same kind of scenario working itself out. At the same time, the U.S. Treasury serves the Wall Street money managers by forcing countries to open up their financial markets to foreign firms. And when, for example, the World Trade Organization was conducting negotiations on financial services and those negotiations broke down, the U.S. Treasury used the negotiations on bailout packages for several Asian countries as clout to force their governments to open up their financial markets to foreign banks and investment firms. Thirdly, the IMF, of course, as we all know, serves as the institutional vehicle for delivering this financial safety net. In collaboration with global money managers and speculators, the IMF ultimately decides not only what structural adjustment programs must be adopted by countries facing financial crisis as part of their rescue operations, but also which domestic enterprises are to be closed down, which ones must be auctioned off to foreign investors at bargain basement prices through fireside sales, and on and on and on. Moreover, the IMF's steadfast refusal to sanction any kind of capital controls by debtor countries as part of their monetary policy also serves the Wall Street financiers. As Bhagwati himself says, the absence of controls on the inflows and outflows of capital in a country's economy only enlarges the arena in which to make more money. Now, indeed, The Wall Street Treasury complex amounts to a vicious circle. For the most part, the IMF's multi-billion dollar bailout operations are not only financed through the U.S. Treasury and the other central banks of the G7 countries, but are mainly carried out by the issuing of public debt. In turn, the issuing of public debt by the U.S. Treasury Department to finance these bailouts tends to be underwritten and guaranteed by the same group of Wall Street merchant banks involved in the speculative assaults in the first place. Nice little convenient collusion, isn't it? As Shavadovsky points out, those who guarantee the issuing of public debt to finance these bailouts are those who will ultimately appropriate the loot. Meanwhile, the vast amounts of money provided through the IMF rescue packages enable recipient countries to meet their debt obligations with the same financial institutions that contributed to the breakdown of their national currencies in the first place. Now, let's just take one example, and that's South Korea. Prominent MIT economist Rudy Dornbusch revealed the U.S. agenda as far as South Korea is concerned when he said in the wake of its financial meltdown, and I quote, "Korea is now owned and operated by our treasury. That's the positive side of this crisis." After high-level consultations with the world's largest commercial and merchant banks, the U.S. Treasury insisted that the IMF bailout agreement lift the ceiling on foreign ownership of Korean corporate predators, lift the ceiling on foreign ownership of Korean industrial assets to 55% and allow 100% ownership, foreign ownership of Korean banks. Foreign corporate predators, that's where it comes in, moved in for the kill. buying up Korean industrial assets at bargain basement prices. Although there was a massive financial flight from South Korea by speculators, some creditors decided to stay behind and take advantage of the crisis by rolling over their loans. But instead of lending at the rate that they had before the crisis of 0.25 percentage points above the London interbank offered rate, they charged a full 6 percentage points above that standard rate, thereby reaping huge windfall profits. In effect, the bailout filled the pockets of the global financial managers but failed to rescue Korean firms, as 200 companies were shut down on a daily basis and 4,000 workers each day were driven out into the streets of the unemployed during the height of the crisis. The damage in Korea is the damage felt all over. We've heard it from Yao, we've heard it from others throughout this day. And whether we're talking about the financial crisis and the bailout packages in Mexico and Thailand and Indonesia or South Korea, in Russia, Brazil, and even in Japan recently, the pattern is pretty well the same. Pillage of the central banks, structural adjustment programs, foreign buyouts and takeovers, massive unemployment, and forced bankruptcies. In effect, what we have here is this huge financial safety net. What the Wall Street Treasury complex does is to provide this safety net in such a way that it provides an ongoing insurance plan for speculative capitalism. Bailing out foreign investors who have delivered speculative assaults on various countries with public funds acts as a perverse incentive for the same investors to take even greater risks. And this is the so-called moral hazard. Speculators will, in fact, take more chances knowing that they will be bailed out again and again and again. So this is the engine, to a large extent, of speculative capitalism and of the global financial casino. But so far, we've just been talking about the post-crisis safety nets. In recent months and year, in the last couple of years, what has happened is that plans have been introduced now to introduce a pre-crisis safety net. It's not enough you have a post-crisis safety net. Now you want to help the investment houses and banks out with a pre-crisis safety net. How did this happen? Well, on October 30th, 1998, the Clinton administration went before the IMF and proposed and outlined a plan for a $90 billion enhanced IMF facility to offer contingent short-term credit for countries pursuing strong IMF-approved policies on the one hand before a crisis occurs and an emergency bailout becomes necessary. Instead of bringing about precautionary measures to deter that this turbulence and the financial turbulence is dealt with, what happens is that an existence of a fund is put in place which in many ways entices speculators to pursue in their deadly raids on national currencies. So this brings us back to the strategic question. What are we going to do about this? And how can we, in fact, start to recognize that it's really in seven countries, the G7 countries, that the real engine is in place? It's here in terms of the U.S. and the U.S. Treasury and Wall Street, but it's also present with those other G7 countries and their central banks. And I think in many ways we have to kind of ask ourselves, just like during the nuclear arms race, do we not need to really think seriously now about a suffocation strategy, a strategy that is designed to cut the lifeline and to cut the oxygen out of this? The oxygen we're talking about are public funds. But the fact is there is no raging public debate in any of the G7 countries about the fact that these public funds are being used to fuel this global financial casino. So I think instead, and in addition to all of the alternatives that were outlined before, whether we're talking about capital controls on capital,
whether we're talking about revitalizing the central banks or erasing the debt or bringing in the Tobin tax or redirecting public investment, private investment for public purposes, or bringing about worker control over pension funds, or a whole series of things. We've also got to make sure that we focus our energies on the real target, and in many ways, the real target is the Wall Street Treasury complex. Let's put the choke chain around it, and let's make sure that the youth blockades that are forming around the IMF and the World Bank in the next few days, that the spirit and the drive and the courage of the youth in those blockades is transformed into a suffocation strategy country by country in each of the G7 countries over the next few years.
Last speaker on this panel is the only one who's been arrested in front of the World Bank and IMF wearing a Kermit the Frog suit. he did this. He did this in 1985 in the waning days of the Marcos dictatorship in his native country, the Philippines. Walden Bello was a leading activist against dictatorship in the Philippines. 15 years later, I'll simply note, on November 30th, 1999, when I was walking down the street with about 40,000 other people in Seattle, I ducked into a hotel to make a phone call, and up on the television screen, which was running the demonstration continuously, there was a policeman grabbing and fairly brutally dragging someone across the street, and the person was in characteristic fashion, fighting back, and it was Walden Bello. When he's not demonstrating, he's written some of the most terrific analyses of globalization. He wrote the first major critique of the World Bank, a book called Development Debacle. He picked the Asian crisis 10 years before it happened in a book called Dragons in Distress. He's now the executive director of Focus on the Global South in Bangkok, Thailand. Please welcome Walden Bello.
Thank you very much. I thought Jan said being dragged away in terroristic fashion. Being the last in a list of brilliant speakers, I have to say that I probably don't have anything to add. But nevertheless, let me try to squeeze my 15 minutes and share with you a number of insights regarding the institutions that we are confronted with. Let me first say that a number of us have come from the third world and from different parts of the world, from Asia, to Washington to join you. We did not come to dialogue with the World Bank and the IMF. We did not come to negotiate with Wolfensohn and Kohler. We actually came to shut down these institutions. About 3 to 4 weeks ago, those of us who opened up the newspapers found a very interesting item, a study that had been commissioned by the United States Congress when it approved the $18 billion quota increase for the IMF in 1998. And the results of that study, called the Meltzer Commission report, had the following four conclusions. One is that the IMF does not promote growth. It instead institutionalizes stagnation. The second is that the World Bank is irrelevant and not central to the battle against poverty. The third is that these institutions are unduly influenced by the political and financial institutions of the G7 countries, particularly the United States. And fourth is that these institutions do not respond so much to external need, but to the imperatives of bureaucratic imperialism. Now, this was a mainstream report. There was very little in it that those who have been following the works of Susan George, of Bruce Rich, of John Kavanaugh, many of the authors here, of Food First, would find new. What was new was that the so-called radical critique, the progressive critique, has now been embraced by a significant part of the mainstream, and that, in fact, this report itself made fairly important recommendations about the downsizing of these institutions. However, the logic of the report is a logic leading to abolition. But being a U.S. government-appointed commission, the commission hesitated on the brink, and instead of recommending what its logic itself would push it to, it said, well, let us try to find a place for these two institutions. We will make the IMF the lender of last resort. Very interesting, because it had just gone through documenting how the IMF had screwed up in one case after the other on being a lender of last resort. And it said, let's rename the World Bank. Call it the World Development Authority and give it some anti-poverty function. after it had gone through about 80 pages documenting how the World Bank had in all cases promoted and created poverty instead of eliminating it. Well, these were the limits. Now, the Meltzer report does not follow the logic of its analysis. It is up to us, to you, to all of us, to follow that logic to its conclusion and to abolish these Jurassic institutions. Let us consign those institutions to where they belong, to history, and to build new institutions that would truly advance the global justice, global equity, global environmental sustainability, and global democracy. These are the values that bring us together here this evening and which unites 99% of the people in the world with you this evening. Let me then move on very briefly to the topic for this evening, which was the casino capitalism. And what I would just like to do is to very briefly go through what we went in Asia and why we went through it and the larger context within which casino capitalism operates. Well, in the early 1990s, was a period when the sector of speculative finance began to drive the U.S. economy. But this was also a period when, because of the dynamics of the system, you had fairly low interest rates and low stock prices, and therefore a crisis of profitability in this sector. Across the Pacific, you had burgeoning economies, so-called miracle economies. And there was tremendous pressure exerted by the hedge funds, the banks, the big commercial banks, the investment funds on the U.S. Treasury Department to open up those economies to capital from the United States, to portfolio investment, and to speculative capital. The tool for this was the International Monetary Fund. To one country after another, it pressured these countries to liberalize their capital accounts and liberalize the entry of portfolio investment and speculative capital into their economies. For their own reasons, the technocrats of the Asian economies agreed and caved in, and with the IMF, they formulated the classical formula consisting of three things. One, financial liberalization, bring in foreign capital to reinvigorate their banking sectors. Second is to maintain high interest rates. Why? In order to be able to attract that capital from the north into these economies, because they would not come in unless there were an interest rate differential. Third is fixed exchange rates, or informally fixed exchange rates, in order to be able to protect these foreign investors from what they called foreign currency risk. So that at the end of the day, if they brought in their money, when they withdrew it, it would still be the same in terms of its dollar value. Therefore, this push for fixed exchange rates did not so much come from those countries, technocrats, but it came from the fund managers working through the U.S. Treasury Department and the International Monetary Fund. $100 billion flowed in between 1994 and 1997. And where this money went in these so-called burgeoning economies was not to the really productive sectors of manufacturing and investment. Guess where that money went? You don't need to guess far. It went into real estate, and it went into the stock market. These were the areas where you could derive high profits and derive them with a very quick turnaround time. These were the boom years. These were the times when almost any self-respecting investment fund had to come to Asia. Now, anybody with common sense, except of course the financial managers and the technocrats of the IMF and our dear old Treasury Department, headed by our dear old Treasury of the Secretary, Larry Summers, formerly chief economist of the World Bank, guess it? Naturally, common sense would lead one to expect overinvestment. And indeed, massive overinvestment took place. Stock prices tumbled. Real estate values came down to the ground because this was a speculative bubble economy. And what happens when that happened is naturally the panic. People wanted to get out before their money was devalued any further. And of course, just like when there is in the throes of a physical crisis of an animal, for instance, there are jackals around. What we also saw were jackals in the form of hedge funds trying to make money out of the plunges in the currencies relative to the dollars, the hedge funds trying to make money out of currency speculation like the Soros Quantum Fund in this process. What we had was a panic exacerbated by the speculative financiers like Soros, and in 6 months alone, $100 billion left the Asian economies. Now, no amount of that magnitude could leave without bringing down, like Samson, the economies of East Asia with it. And indeed, they came tumbling down. The next phase of the drama, the 7th Cavalry, headed by General Custer, General Kam Dae-soo, came in with, incidentally, before I forget, thank you very much, Mr. Bob Nyman of Preamble, for giving Mr. Kam Dae-soo a pie in the face. Bob Nyman, where are you? Okay. Came in with $100 billion in rescue packages, and as Tony Clark said, it was not to rescue these economies, it was to give the government money to pay off the foreign creditors of the local firms. In other words, private sector debt to foreign private sector creditors was socialized. The people ended up with a burden in the future to pay off these funds that had been borrowed by their governments to the IMF, and they will pay that far into the future. The IMF also came in with a formula that was supposed to revive these economies, but again, as people in Africa and Latin America had experienced, this formula, which involved cutbacks in government budgets and the institution of high credit rates, created a situation worse than before. So that what we had was, in 1998, the Korean economy plunged by 10%, Thailand by 8%, and in Indonesia by 25%. What was a crisis was turned into a disaster by the International Monetary Fund, by General Kam Dae-soo, backed by Marshall, Larry Summers, and Robert Rubin. Now, the results were devastating, because in the end, we really have to talk about human beings being played around with. In Indonesia, the statistics do not capture the intensity of the poverty rate going from 11.2% of the population to 60% in 6 months. In Thailand, we had an unemployment rate that rose to 6 to 8% of the workforce, it was 9% in South Korea in 1998. These were the really bleak times. Not the end of the story, as Tony Clark said, because the U.S. Treasury Department used the crisis to follow through on a decades-long agenda for opening up Asian trade, investment, and capital markets by, as Tony said, bringing with the IMF measures of deregulation, privatization, and liberalization, which has now ended with so many of these economies, assets which had been built up over a generation, passing at fire sale prices to American and European firms. Let me just sum up what best describes the situation. And it is not a radical critic, but Mr. Jeff Garten himself, who is formerly the undersecretary of Mr. Clinton in his early administration. And Mr. Garten said, and I quote, "Most of these countries are going to go through a deep and dark tunnel. But on the other end, there is going to be a significantly different Asia in which American firms have achieved much greater market penetration, much greater access," unquote. Let me end by trying to forestall the bell with just a plea to put this in a bigger picture, and very quickly. If there is such tremendous hyperactivity in the financial sector, this is because of a crisis of overcapacity and overproduction. And if we see these moves towards tremendous monopolization at this point, Microsoft, Mobil, Exxon, BP, Amoco, this is all a result of the crisis of profitability within the industrial sector. And this is why money goes into the financial sector for speculation. Now, the reason for overcapacity, let me just sum it up in one thing, that capitalism, while it creates great wealth, also creates great poverty. It creates great wealth for many, for a few, but creates massive poverty and therefore a tremendous lack of purchasing power for billions in the world today. So, let us face it. There is a specter haunting the world. And what is the name of that specter? Globalization? Yes, but let us not use euphemisms. That specter is capitalism. Abolishing the World Bank and the IMF is only one step in the way of bringing about a reign of global justice, equity, democracy, and sustainability. Seattle and Washington were only the first legs of a long march. Let us remember that. Let us also remember that so long as we have courage, we have clear thinking, and above all, we have compassion for one another, nothing can stop us. We will prevail. Venceremos.
And we'll close our program with this little news and announcement. On May 27th, a micropower broadcasting council of war has been called for Berkeley, California. In response to the National Association of Broadcasters' open declaration of war on the micropower broadcasting movement, community radio, and free speech, a national gathering of micropower broadcasters, media activists, and supporters will convene in Berkeley, California on Saturday, May 27th. Our goal is to plan and create a national campaign for the liberation of the broadcast airwaves from the corporate media stranglehold on the free flow of news, information, artistic expression, and cultural diversity. Not only will we increase our efforts in FM broadcasting, we will expand them to include micropower AM and TV broadcasting as well. You are cordially invited to attend this very important meeting. The National Association of Broadcasters is exercising raw corporate muscle, money, and political influence to ensure that only the very rich and powerful mega media corporations have access to the airwaves, a public resource. If legislation sponsored on behalf of the NAB becomes law, then what little crumbs the FCC has given to community broadcasting in the form of the new low-power FM service will be swept from the table. It is our intent to shut down the NAB's radio convention, which will be held in San Francisco from September 20th to September 23rd, 2000. To the NAB we say, up against the wall, Seattle is coming to the airwaves. For further information, contact Stephen Dunifer at Free Radio Berkeley, area code 510-549-0732, or check out the Free Radio Berkeley website at www.freeradio.org.
The music used in today's program was Food and Health and Hope by Seize the Day and Senior Service by Elvis Costello. The Globalization Cell Phone Drill Team was created and performed by United for a Fair Economy. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio4all.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. My guns and my saddle.